Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our talk show for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, the guest is Kathy Kelly. The name might not be immediately familiar to some people who are listening, but of all of the folks in this country who have been involved in actively demonstrating against U.S. policy in Iraq, the war there, U.N. sanctions against Iraq, she is one of the best known. She is one of the founders of a group called Voices in the Wilderness that has been around since 1996. It's a group that is dedicated to nonviolent social change, and the major tactic they have settled on is to organize delegations of people, Americans, to go to Iraq in a very direct and deliberate violation of both the UN sanctions and American law. Kathy has been to Iraq 20 times since January of 1996, when that campaign began. Recently, she was there during the war and the occupation. She was there for a number of months, and then just this past summer, the end of the summer, she was again back to try to make some assessment of how things are going in that country. A little bit more about her. She grew up in Chicago. She has taught in schools around the area in community colleges and high schools. She taught at St. Ignatius College Prep School there. She's active with the Catholic Worker Movement as a pacifist and war refuser. And as I said, has been to Iraq a number of times since this organization, Voices in the Wilderness, got going. She's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana, and if you're interested in hearing her and perhaps meeting her, there are a couple of opportunities. There'll be a noon lunch and informal conversation at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. Then there'll be a town meeting tonight at the Champaign Public Library, panel presentation and a discussion. Our own Jack Brighton will be the moderator. That's the Champaign Public Library at 505 South Randolph in Champaign. And if you're interested in finding out more information about Voices in the Wilderness, they do have a website. So if you have internet access, you can go there. And here on the program, if you have questions, you'd like to talk with our guest, you pick up the phone and dial the number 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, David.
Knowing something about your background, I guess it wouldn't be real surprising that you would end up doing the kind of work that you've done, but I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about how it is, maybe I'll ask how it is that Voices in the Wilderness specifically got started.
Well, a number of us had been to Iraq in 1991 or 1990, in other words, before or during or immediately after the Gulf War then. And when we came back to the United States, I think questions about Iraq, concerns about Iraq, eventually faded back to the back burners. Even though we knew that economic sanctions had been imposed and that they were still in place and that it must be terribly difficult for Iraqis to rebuild under those circumstances, I think most of us, even though we'd been in Iraq during the war, many of us, or had gone to try, some had been part of a delegation to try to release some hostages, and some had gone over to do scientific assessments post-war, We stopped paying attention. And then by 1995, some really awful statistics were coming through. A British medical journal, The Lancet, had published a letter to the editor by two women who said that when they calculated the infant mortality tables that they had worked on for the United Nations, it could be that as many as 500,000 children under age 5 had died as a direct result of the economic sanctions. And it was clear that these sanctions weren't dislodging Saddam Hussein's regime. I mean, it wasn't clear that he even missed a meal. And yet people who'd committed no crime, children, were paying a horrible, grotesque price. So we happened to be in Chicago, a number of us, for a conference on conflict resolution. And in fact, we were using as a simulation the issue of controversy over Iraq, trying to sort of show what we would do if we were to do something about this issue. And I think we all collectively blushed and said, how can we view this as though we're playing house, you know, or let's pretend, and we aren't really doing anything. And so and that's when we decided, well, at least we can't be a relief organization, we know, but at least we can put into practice something we do know how to use, and that is nonviolent resistance to policies that are abysmally and cruelly unjust. And that's when we started the Voices in the Wilderness campaign. Mm-hmm. It was quite simple and streamlined. We said that we would go to Iraq carrying medicines and medical relief supplies in direct and open defiance of the economic sanctions.
What you have done, I feel certain, has helped some individual Iraqis. Do you feel that in any way what you have done has at all changed the bigger picture?
Well, I suppose there's a kind of an accordion, David, when we think about bigger picture. I believe that democracy is based on information, and I believe that people in the United States have needed to have some very basic information that hasn't always been very accessible. Now, we were the most motley crew of small grassroots groups imaginable. You know, we worked and we still continue to work out of my two-bedroom apartment on the north side of Chicago. But I am aware that back in 1990, I was certainly not the only peace activist in the United States who could spell Iraq, find Kuwait on a map, and that about exhausted what I knew about Iraq. By the eve of the United States going forward with this most recent bombing campaign, there were communities all across this country who were really quite savvy, quite well informed about conditions in Iraq, about the effects of the economic sanctions, about who is benefiting from the recycling of petrodollars in the course of United States dominance over oil in the Middle East. There really was a great deal of information out there. Now, why did that happen? I think in part the small delegations that traveled with Voices in the Wilderness in the early years of our campaign, 96, 97, 98, coming back and telling their neighbors and friends and people that they worshipped with or people they worked with, this is what we've seen and heard, was a bit of a magnet. And it caused bigger organizations, more credible organizations like the American Friends Service Committee and Veterans for Peace and Pax Christi USA and Fellowship of Reconciliation to say, well, we should go over to Iraq also. And eventually you found religious leaders going over. And eventually even some congresspeople finally exercised a little bit of oversight and took a trip over there themselves. And internationally also, many people were educating themselves about Iraq so that actually before the Gulf War Part II, this most recent one, the anti-war movement came closer than it ever has before to that critical mass that would be necessary to stop a war before it starts. I mean, even the New York Times referred to the world's second superpower being public opinion. And I think Voices did something to contribute toward that on an absolute shoestring budget and with the volunteer labor of primarily young people in their 20s who were impassioned and determined and honest.
When people talk about the recent war, I think that there are a lot of people who say something like, well, whatever you think about the war, whether it was right or wrong, the people of Iraq are better off now that Saddam Hussein is no longer in power. Now, you've been there a number of times over a number of years, before the war, after the war, so you should be in a position to at least offer your own thoughts about whether the people of Iraq are better off now than they were before. Mm. Are they?
You know, I would like so much to say something conclusive, but that wouldn't be honest. I think, in a sense, the jury is still out. Certainly, at this immediate moment, people that I've known are feeling betrayed and frustrated and bewildered. They thought that once liberated from the regime of Saddam Hussein, things would start to get better, that the United States would have their interests in mind. But, for instance, when 12 armored personnel carriers were dispatched to protect Iraq's oil ministry, where the information and the maps are located for securing Iraq's oil wealth for the future, and yet hospitals descended into virtual war zones, that sent a signal out to many people all across Baghdad and beyond that perhaps the only thing that they were going to be liberated from was the notion that the United States really had as a top priority the cares and concerns of Iraqi people. But, I in some ways I liken it to a very difficult custody case where a judge has to sit back and weigh the evidence, and the judge's responsibility is to decide what's best for the children. I think all of us right now who voiced care and concern for ordinary people in Iraq have got to sit back and ask ourselves, top priority, what is best for Iraq's people? And it's hard to say. I mean, I don't really think that the United States government is overwhelmingly concerned about what's happening in clinics and hospitals and with universities and schools in Iraq. But it may be that as Iraq's oil products start to reach back to levels that where they can even consider a surplus, that there will at least be some purchasing power going into the pockets of breadwinners and families, and we might hope for that. But it doesn't seem as though you could really expect that kind of improvement until 2 years down the line. And right now, people are struggling with very inadequate electricity, still don't have phone service throughout many areas of the country. And the primary problem people told us about was the lack of security. Again and again, people would say things like, you can live on one meal a day, but we have to have security. You just can't imagine the frustration caused by the chaos and the looting and the fright that people feel about even going out on the streets.
That's one thing the United States has certainly been criticized for, that is the failure to understand and prepare for what would happen after the government fell. And you could certainly say that, charge the government with being naive for expecting that civil society would just continue to function after the government was gone. At the same time, and I know this is going to sound like I'm blaming the victim, people will say, well, why did that happen? Maybe the United States was naive to think that the day after Saddam Hussein was gone, that the people of Iraq would wake up and say, thank God, and now let's get on with life, and everybody would go to work and things would move smoothly. The United States did not expect that average Iraqis would start to loot the hospitals so that they would have to provide security. I mean, why do you think that happened? Why is it that Iraqi society, after that, so rapidly fell apart?
Well, I don't find that myself all that unthinkable if I just try and relate it to Chicago. I mean, I don't know where Chicago ranks in terms of safety in cities on some kind of worldwide chart, but I generally feel pretty safe walking the streets of Chicago morning, noon, and night. But if you were to empty every prison and jail in the state of Illinois and presume that many of those prisoners would flock towards Chicago, right now they're all emptied, and then you fire the entire Chicago police force and any kind of governing authority, and then you make it clear that the lid is off, there's nobody exercising any oversight, you bet a social volcano would erupt within Chicago. The Magnificent Mile would be in very bad shape, and I can well imagine that there would be looting and what people would refer to as mindless and reckless action. But okay, let's think about that a little further. Wanton and mindless looting of the planet, for instance. I'm involved in that every day as soon as I get out of bed in the morning with the level of consumption and the level of waste that I participate in. And then if you want to think a little further about mindless and wanton looting of Iraq's resources in terms of their oil wealth, let's wait and see who's got their hand in the till and who's using up the fossil fuels that it took for, I think, 400 billion years to develop in the first place, and we might burn them all up in 100 years. So I think that we ought to have perspective on that. And also, in terms of blaming the victim, I think we should remember that Iraq's people have been subjected to 13 years of privation and hardship, and anger and resentment was likely to be burgeoning all the time. And you blame whomever is closest. You know, if there's a big dump of snow in the intersection in Chicago, people aren't going to blame the federal government if the snow isn't removed. They're going to blame the mayor. And so I think a lot of poor people in Iraq, and believe me, there were just sprawling neighborhoods of intense poverty in Baghdad and outside of Baghdad, those people looked at those who seemed to enjoy some kind of affluence, those who seemed to have power and prestige related to ministries, and they said, this is it. We're going to level the playing field, and people who laid no claim to our cares and concerns for many years are going to find that we don't lay much claim to their cares and concerns. And so there was, yes, very, very widespread looting. But I know that there would be some within Iraq who might wonder if the United States was not so naive, and if possibly the United States, maybe not the entire government that was planning the war, but some planners, some architects of this war may have thought, look, if there's enough insecurity, if there's enough of a clamor for security, then we can bring back in a strong-arm government. We can even recycle old elements of the Secret Service and the Republican Guard, which in fact is happening, documented, verified. And they'll put up with it because something will be better than nothing, and they'll want some kind of strong-arm government. And that may be the best option for the United States. I don't know that the United States really wants a democracy in Iraq where there would be representation of the 60 to 70% of people in Iraq who are Shia in their practice of Islam, and some of whom may link up to Iran next door, which is defined by a theocratic Islamic fundamentalist state. Hmm.
Just, I have a caller here, and I will get to them. I promise not to make them wait too long. But given the fact that sanctions were in place for such a long time, and then there was the devastation of the war, even under the best circumstances one could imagine, you would have to believe that to rebuild the country would take a long time. It's not something that could be done in a matter of months. It's likely something that would take years. I wonder if you have some sense of how long it might take if we could design the best government we could possibly think of and give them the money that it would take, what their own oil revenue would produce, and even more if that was necessary. You know, how many years would it take to rebuild and reconstruct after a war and then all of those years of sanctions?
I suppose that would depend to some extent on what standards you were going to expect in terms of the rebuilding. Iraqis were joking that when the power went out in New York, to give advice to New Yorkers would involve telling them, look, why don't you get Saddam to get your power back on and not the United States, because he can do it a lot faster. After 1991, every single electrical facility cross-country had been damaged by the bombing. The grid was out. And within months, Iraqi engineers working round the clock, cobbling together a new electrical generation, using cannibalized parts from here, there, and everywhere, managed to get the electricity functioning much better, in fact, than what they've got at the present moment in Iraq. And so some are saying, look, if Saddam could do this in a matter of months, why can't the United States get this show on the road? It seems to me that there have been terrible delays, and of course some of it has been due to looting and sabotage. But we're told right now that it will take 2 years to get Iraq's electrical facilities restored to pre-Shock and Awe campaign Gulf War levels, and that's very dispiriting for people. My guess is that if you want to start from scratch, start completely all over, and also invoke the assistance of mainstream United States companies, it could take a very long time and be hugely expensive. And of course, many Iraqis are going to say, why not use Iraqi labor? Why can't some of that those lucrative contracts be ones that would pay out money to Iraqis to rebuild the country?
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Kathy Kelly. She is a peace activist, perhaps one of this country's best known. She is one of the founders of a group called Voices in the Wilderness that's been around since 1996, a group that has campaigned actively against economic sanctions imposed by the UN on Iraq, against the recent U.S. war. And their main tactic for doing that has been to organize delegations of Americans to send them to Iraq in a deliberate violation of UN sanctions and a U.S. law. Kathy Kelly has gone on a number of these trips, 20 times, I think, since January of 1996. She was there during the war and also more recently. She's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana and will make a couple of appearances. A little bit later, I'll tell you again about where she will be if you would like to hear her. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, it seems that, and I'm sure you're going to agree with this, but our priorities are completely reversed in Iraq, that while we might not expect the Bush administration to get priorities right, the Democrats are even playing along in Congress, because while almost everybody seems to have no question about allocating money for the military to maintain troops there, they're pretty much in unison questioning the little bit of expenditures to be put forth towards rebuilding Iraq, and questioning about whether we have any responsibility to, you know, rebuild the country after we've destroyed it. And you know, if they really are interested in winning hearts and minds, it seems like that's exactly the wrong tack to take.
Well, I would surely be in agreement with that. I think that we do have a responsibility to the bereaved, to the wounded, to those whose neighborhoods and facilities have been destroyed. And it seems to me that you're quite right about any effort to win over hearts and minds. In fact, it seems to be an opposite direction has been taken. I would even wonder if those who might have expected that there could almost be a honeymoon in the initial days of the occupation might not have been right, that the troops could have been welcomed and that a rebuilding process might have started right away had there been some kind of security and plan that came forth with the occupation.
Yeah, I don't know if it is, as you were saying, that maybe this is some sort of unstated plan to create such chaos that then they can reinstate another sort of benevolent dictatorship in Iraq, or if there's just hubris on their part that they really believe their own rhetoric. The only really good outcome I can see from all this is that if the U.S. military is tied down in Iraq, they can't carry out any more of these adventures somewhere else in the world. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go on to our next caller. This is Champaign County and line number two. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. That was sort of the same sort of question I was going to ask, the idea that no one's questioning the military spending. But I've heard one analysis of this so-called $20 billion that $5 billion of it is actually for police training, so it's also could be pushed over into the other side in a way, in that it's not for reconstruction. That leaves $15 billion, and I've also understood that $15 billion is the amount of money that the Oil for Food program was bringing in, and that was just basically, you know, providing food for 60 or so percent of the population. So it isn't like it's a huge amount of money to rebuild, considering that the infrastructure, not just centers of Saddam's power, as it was called, but places like the public health ministry and the electrical ministry and all these things were shocked and awed. So I maybe want to respond to that. I also think that this idea that they were possibly planning for the chaos. I don't think they cared about chaos. They just figured force would work, whether it can be done directly by the U.S. or whether we need to have a Saddamism without Saddam, that they think that they can do it. And I actually worry that, you know, they still might be right, because the media isn't actually conveying you. I don't know how many Ann Gorell interviews you've had, or whatever her name is, the NPR reporter. I don't know how many times she asked you for your insight while you were both in Baghdad. Anyway, I'll hang up. I'm sure there's a lot of people queuing up to talk to you. Very good.
Okay. Well,
thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any comment, response to the call you want to make?
Well, it's not in a direct response. I appreciate those thoughtful remarks a lot, but a number of us are wondering if the United States had never really wanted a regime change so much as a leadership change. I think that must be what you meant when you said Saddamism without Saddam. And the idea that already some people queuing up in front of the Coalition Provisional Authority building asking for help with various problems are saying, and by the way, many can't even get to first base unless they take a Westerner with them, some university kids who work out of our building where we have a house in Baghdad. They create a newspaper on the ground floor of that house, jokingly made a poster in it. It said, a new NGO, Rent a Whitey, and had my picture on it. Well, it's clever. But it's also kind of true that people need to have some kind of accompaniment to even go over there with their problems. A number of them have said to us that they can't speak freely to the designated people that are supposed to be in charge in their area, people designated by the Coalition Provision Authority or the occupation, because those are people that are known to be former Baathists, and they feel very, very insecure about that. So we're really starting to wonder if perhaps the intent was leadership change, but to keep the old strong-arm regime as a means both to keep the country intact but also for control over people, which is very much wanted, I think, on the part of many big companies and big interests who are now investing in Iraq.
Another caller here, Charleston, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I guess what's absolutely infuriating to me is that none of this was unpredicted. When they were trying to get the authorization from the Senate to go into Iraq, Robert Byrd was on the floor for like all day talking about the relationship between this decision and the Gulf of Tonkin decision. I emailed, I called, and did all those kinds of things. People said, of course we were going to win the war. That was obvious. Whether or not we could build a peace afterwards was completely it was very clear, at least to me, to a number of other people, that was where the hard job was going to be, that we've not been good at this in the past. And so it's infuriating for me to listen to people say, well, they just didn't realize, or they didn't understand, the administration didn't understand how difficult it was going to be, or whatever. They should have understood. They should have listened to the people who were saying things like, that's going to be the really hard work, we're not good at that, we don't have a track record that indicates that we're good at that. And that, all of this is apart from whether or not we should have gone in. I mean, that's a whole other issue. So I find it extremely frustrating to listen to people say they just didn't understand, they just didn't predict. And for me personally, I mean, I really tend to believe that for George Bush, this was a war he could win. We still don't have Osama bin Laden. Things in Afghanistan are not going well, and it was much easier to go in there and bomb Iraq than it was to actually try to deal with the September 11th attacks with the people who did those, as Saddam was an easier target. And I really believe that was the major motivation politically for him, was this could be supposedly a win for him when he couldn't win with regard to Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden, the September 11th tragedy. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Well put. You know, it's kind of hard to imagine how a military could have so much incompetence as not to win a war militarily when you've got the arsenals that the United States military has built up and the strength. I mean, when it comes to using strength and force and threat and force, nobody can top the capacity of the U.S. military. But, of course, that isn't all that's involved in winning wars. We have a friend, Mill Rye, who just wrote a book called Regime Unchanged, subtitled Why the War Against Iraq Was Unnecessary and Changed Nothing. And he says, this is a quote from him, he says, "Never before have so many been so right about so much of real and lasting significance." And I hope that the anti-war movement, the huge number of grassroots peace groups that sprang up in opposition to the war, will kind of take that to heart, that they were right in the first place, and not allow those who said that the people opposed to the war were shameless and stupid to continue to engage in put-down. I think that we have actually a responsibility not to carp and complain, but to say, look, one way to prevent a next war, as one of the earlier callers suggested, while the U.S. troops are tied up in Iraq, maybe it won't be possible to launch a next war. But, you know, our track record is we go from hot war to hot war to hot war. Maybe one way to prevent a next war is to very fully tell the truth about this war. And that means continuing to have the grassroots meetings where people come together and get collectively the kind of education we need to have in order to speak confidently and speak truthfully about what has happened. And my guess is that some of the returning soldiers will join that discussion and themselves will be a bit disenchanted with the war that they were sent off to fight.
Yeah. Again, I appreciate the comments of the call. We have somebody else who's calling on a cell phone in North Urbana, so we'll go to them, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to make two comments. First, I need to disagree with your guest and with the previous caller in that I spoke to many, many people against the war and before it happened, and I listened to the discussions in Congress and watched the political pundits. And while I think there was certainly knowledge that it would be difficult after the war to establish a regime change, if you will, I don't think there was any recognition that what we were doing were basically creating a center point for a jihad with people coming in from all over the regions, including Afghanistan. I don't think that was anticipated. But I know that that's sort of a side issue, and it does bother me nowadays when people are still discussing who's to blame instead of discussing what do we do now that we're in a Vietnam situation. And the other comment I just want to make is a lot of the discussion is about politics and policy. And I think one day, maybe far in the future, there eventually going to be a discussion as to whether this war was a war that was waged by George W. Bush in to fulfill the failure of his father, and also the people in his administration who were, in fact, the peers of his father, and that there's a real strong psychological basis for this war and not just a policy basis, otherwise, obviously, there's that as well. Hmm. Okay, thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, I'd like to maybe look a little bit further at the idea of there being a relationship between George Bush Jr. and George Bush Sr. George Bush Sr. went to an energy conference at Rio, and he said the American way of life is a non-negotiable, meaning no matter what anybody thinks about energy concerns, U.S. people are not going to change the way we live. And you know, I think by the judgment of many people in other parts of the world, we must be deemed as people living an incredibly overconsumptive and wasteful lifestyle. And I myself think that George Bush Jr. is in line with that line of thinking, that it is terribly important for the United States to maintain control over the recycling of petrodollars back into the United States economy, and that the United States very much wanted to have basing inside of Iraq, and that that had a great deal to do with why this war was fought. And the maintenance of economic sanctions over those 13 years also was in line with the idea that the United States could have control and dominance over the recycling of the petrodollars. And as long as the Iraqi oil wasn't on the market, then the Saudis were able to just about double their output of oil, and they could be relied on to invest their petrodollars in United States financing companies and U.S. banks. So it seems to me that there is a thread that ties in, and I don't know that it's so much an emotional, psychological one as a bottom line is profit type of line.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Kathy Kelly. She is one of the country's best-known peace activists, one of the founders of the group Voices in the Wilderness that has been around since 1996, a group that was organized to campaign against U.N. sanctions against Iraq and also U.S. policy in Iraq. And as I have explained a couple times, their main tactic for doing this has been to organize delegations of Americans, send them there to Iraq in deliberate violation of U.S. law. The group has been nominated 3 times for the Nobel Peace Prize. Again, they're among the nominees this year. Although Kathy said when I mentioned that to her a little bit earlier that she would be surprised to win. But nonetheless, there has been that recognition now 3 times. Questions are welcome here at 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. As I have now mentioned a couple times, your trips, the trips that the Voices has organized and you've been involved in, are against the law. And the U.S. government, now going back a number of years, first threatened your organization with a fine and then finally imposed the fine that you and the Voices folks have very consistently said, we will not pay that fine. If you want to put us in jail, okay, we'll do that. Where exactly does now the legal proceeding involving you and Voices and the U.S. government stand?
Much to our surprise, during the point when the United States was moving toward preparation for the Operation Shock and Awe campaign in November of 2002, when we in fact had a sizable number of people on the ground in Iraq ready to stay there before enduring such a war, we suddenly learned that the U.S. had decided to impose the fine that had been threatened for many years, and $10,000 was imposed on me personally, $10,000 on the campaign itself, and then $10,000 on each of 3 other travelers. And consistently, we've said, yes, we did exactly what we're accused of doing. We don't believe it's a crime, but yes, we did bring medicines and some toys to children and families in Iraq. And we've also said that we won't pay the fines, and we raised equivalent sums for the first round of fines that were imposed and took that money over and invested it in a rehydration clinic in southern Basra and also bringing some additional cancer meds over. Then we got a summons after I'd returned from Iraq late July. We got a summons saying that we had 20 days during which time we must respond as to why we haven't paid these fines. So we wrote up another document explaining why we weren't paying the fines. But we also discovered that in the actual wording of this most recent charge, we're charged with bringing medicines and medical relief supplies to Iraq. But when you examine the code, the U.S. government code does specifically exempt bringing donated medical relief over to Iraq. So it may be that a judge could say, well, hang on, it's very clear that what we're charging them with in this particular case, although they did do it, it was exempted from the code. Nevertheless, we decided to countersue the U.S. government, and we filed a brief late last week countersuing the U.S. government and saying that there should be an injunction against the U.S. government from any future efforts to prosecute people who've gone over to Iraq on a humanitarian basis, because the economic sanctions themselves were in violation of the UN Charter of International Law and were deemed by United Nations humanitarian coordinators, 2 of whom resigned their posts, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck, as genocidal. So I don't know what a judge will make of all of this. You'd have more time in front of a judge defending yourself for a parking ticket than we'll get in front of a judge for these charges, and we won't see a jury on these charges. And that's why we've said if the United States wants to initiate criminal charges against us, we're ready and waiting. I would love to go before a jury of my peers and explain why I don't believe I acted criminally when I bought medicines to hospitals where children were gasping, being strangulated, tortured, because they couldn't get the most basic medicines needed in order to help them when they were dying from malnutrition and waterborne diseases.
We have another caller here in Champaign, line 1. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
First of all, I commend Ms. Kelly, because I think that the only way out of all of this morass of injustice in the world is through peaceful initiative. But I do have a couple of questions. Number one, under what circumstances would you believe or your group believe that the United Nations or any sovereign country would be justified in taking military or, in some cases, they may call it police action?
Well, I guess I do want to acknowledge that I haven't given up on pacifism personally. I don't expect to hold the United Nations to pacifism, but I believe that the United Nations has the capacity, if it's well-funded and given resources by the countries who have an ability to make contributions, or maybe by some new system of taxing exchanges that are made. The United Nations could go into situations where there is a deterioration within a country before it gets to be so bad that people are going to be picking up weapons and fighting against each other. I think that the United Nations could do much more to uphold its own charter in trying to engage in the kinds of human rights respect that would prevent wars from breaking out. And so I'm not ready to say that there ought to be armed interventions. I think also every peace team that I've been a part of has wanted to be an arrow to point toward the possibility of unarmed intervention. You would find people all around the world who would say, yes, send us, but it would take a tremendous commitment of resource and building of peace teams to have any lasting significance in situations of conflict. But I believe that there are many, many idealistic and determined people who have the same courage that soldiers have. Soldiers are sent into these conflicts, into war zones, expecting to risk their lives and to risk their security. And they go in with arms, and we commend them. We applaud them. Well, I think you would find people ready to take the same risk, but also ready to go in unarmed if they could go in large numbers and with the support of the United Nations and ideally third-party neutral forces.
I think that the issue of courage and bravery, I agree with you, that those people who go in for idealistic concepts, for pacifism or for any of those, do exhibit the same issues of bravery and courage. I think in a way, though, it's beside the point. We're a military family. A lot of people in my family are in the military, as was I. And I don't believe that the military solution should be exercised in almost any case, unless it's desperate circumstances. One of the issues I do find intriguing, however, has a parallel, and I'll give the parallel and then hang up and let you discuss the parallel, see if it's true or not, is the issue of somebody on your block, for instance, you know who's beating their children. You see them in the yard, and they're bleeding, and you call the police, and the police basically do nothing because this is that kind of neighborhood, and the police just aren't effective. And in fact, they won't come very often. There are some areas in some of our major cities where that happens even now. What responsibility do you have as a neighbor to try to stop that kind of abuse of the children, other family members, the mother, the father, whatever? Is there ever a time when you would, by means of even defensive force, which means you don't go drop a bomb in the house, you go and, if necessary, take the children, family away or things like that? I'm just wondering how a pacifist, a large group of them, could do anything to prevent that kind of issue. And you see, my parallel is to a larger issue where you have a nation that's obviously abusing, which is a very euphemistic word, its citizenry. I'm not claiming that this is what happened in Iraq, by the way.
Well,
that was going on. But the parallel is one I'm interested in exploring.
Yeah, I appreciate the comment. Let's give Kathy a chance to talk about it.
Well, that's an extremely helpful parallel. I mean, certainly if a social worker had gone to the home where she knew or he knew that there was an abusive person molesting and mutilating the children, if that social worker had then created conditions such that the children would never be able to get adequate food or medicine and were isolated completely, and the social worker went away and let that go on year after year after year, then we would all want to say that social worker really needs to be relieved of the job. And I think that to a certain extent, that's what the UN-US sanctions did. We knew that the sanctions were not affecting Saddam Hussein. We knew that the children were continuing to suffer in at ghastly levels of what would be we'd call child sacrifice, and yet the policy continued on and on and on. Now, what responsibility do average, ordinary people have when they can see that the social worker and the police and the mayor and everybody else isn't making a difference? Well, you, I think, gave a very good pointer when you said people might try to make sure that they get the children out from under the abusive parent. Well, that would be one thing, to try to extricate people out from under the situation, or to create a situation so that the abusive parent can't go back into the house. Now, it's my belief that if the United States had lifted the sanctions, we would have unleashed within the Iraqi people who were trapped under Saddam Hussein a great deal of energy to clamor for a better situation, because now Saddam could no longer blame the sanctions as the reason for why people weren't experiencing any progress, why they were trapped in penury and misery. And I think also, had there been assurance that the United States would help people build their education, build their middle class, build their communication, build their social services, then I think there would have been a fighting chance that the Iraqi people would have been able to dislodge Saddam Hussein's regime. I would look to Iran, I would look to Romania as instances where internal revolutions happened. And in fact, in the case of Iran, even though the United States was supporting the Shah of Iran. But for Iraq, we very much followed the parallel you first suggested, where everybody walked away from the cares and concerns of the children and, in fact, practiced policies that solidified the power of the abuser, in this case, Saddam Hussein, who definitely was dictatorially running a ruthless and a brutally efficient police state.
We, I think, are going to have to stop, I'm sorry, we have something we cannot take, and I'm sure we can continue, could continue, but we're at the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you would like to hear more from our guest, Kathy Kelly, she'll be making two appearances today, the first at noon, a noon lunch and informal conversation at the Channing Murray Foundation at 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. And then tonight at 7 o'clock, a town meeting at the Champaign Public Library. That's at 505 South Randolph in Champaign. And if you are interested in just learning some more about the organization that she helped to start, Voices in the Wilderness, and you have access to the Internet, they do have a website. So you just put Voices in the Wilderness into your browser, and I'm sure that it will direct you there, and you can read about what the organization has done. There are things like press releases and information on Kathy and other people who have been involved. So that's one way to find out more about it. Thank you very much.
David, thank you. It's been a privilege to hear from your callers as well. We also update www.electronicirock.net on a daily basis, and that includes input from our team on the ground in Baghdad.
All right. Kathy Kelly, one of the founders of Voices in the Wilderness, based in Chicago. Yeah, thanks
thank
very
you.
Much.